From the American College of Cardiology, this is Dr. Kim Eagle, ACC.org Editor-in-Chief, with this week's Eagle's Eye View. This is your weekly cardiovascular update from ACC.org. This week, I've chosen a couple of articles that I think are relevant to the practice of perioperative medicine. Cardiovascular care providers like you and I, we spend a lot of time doing preoperative evaluations in patients who do have or may have cardiovascular disease. And we also spend time dealing with patients who have heart disease who need non-cardiac surgery and they're in trouble and how do we manage them. And so I have two pieces that I thought we would cover today that I think are relevant. One of them is a wonderful summary of how we handle patients who have an ACS, acute coronary syndrome, and they need a non-cardiac operation in the near term. And this review was written by Dennis Narcisse and Sunil Rao. It's available on acc.org. And it presents a case, a patient who was 70 years old, had rectal cancer, and had unstable angina and a small non-STEMI. And then the GI evaluation identified an important 5-centimeter friable mass in the esophagus. This patient needs to have cancer surgery. The patient continues to have instability and ends up getting a PCI. And the question, of course, is, okay, if they need GI surgery, but I have to deal with their ACS, what should I do? Should I do plain old balloon angioplasty? Should I put in a bare metal stent? Should I do drug-eluting stent? It's a great piece, and it reviews kind of the current knowledge in this area. The current guidelines say that we want to defer non-cardiac surgery for typically at least 6 weeks after a bare metal stent. And the current guidelines basically would say that we should defer elective non-cardiac surgery after a drug-eluting stent for a year. More recent studies of some of the newer stents have suggested that perhaps the newer generation drug-eluting stents, it's perfectly safe to wait 6 months and then go forward with a non-cardiac surgery. And the European guidelines currently list that as a class 2A indication. And at least currently, the evidence still suggests perhaps that bare metal stents have a shorter window when dual antiplatelet therapy absolutely must be maintained. And then one could interrupt that therapy for a brief period of time, hopefully just one of the agents, and then start it after the non-cardiac surgery. So interesting, if you look at some fairly large observational studies, they certainly suggest that after 6 months with either type of stent, non-cardiac surgery is associated with a pretty low risk of stent thrombosis. In this particular case, the patient had an acute coronary syndrome, a non-STEMI. They were unstable. They had to have their coronary fixed. And the choice was to go ahead with the bare metal stent and then proceed with non-cardiac surgery in about 6 weeks or so. Clearly, if a person is bleeding out, they're going to need to do the operation sooner. The risk of stent thrombosis really goes down aggressively over the first 30 days after we've put in a stent. So certainly after the first week or two, the risk is lower. And if one has to do what they have to do, you accept some risk for stent thrombosis. It's a nice case report, and I recommend it to you. I think it's very well written, and the references are very up to date. And it's an area that we encounter with some regularity. So that's kind of how we deal with the patient with an acute coronary syndrome who needs non-cardiac surgery, and particularly how we might wrestle with the dual antiplatelet drugs. An interesting notion as well, one that's not covered in this article, is the observation that a myocardial infarction itself tends to create a pro-inflammatory response that makes subsequent myocardial infarction more likely, not just in the culprit lesion, but elsewhere for a period of months after the MI. And the same thing has been observed with stroke. This is why a recent stroke is a significant predictor of risk of myocardial infarction in patients who are in the first 3 months after a stroke. So food for thought, recent stroke ends up being a pretty important cardiac predictor and is part of that revised cardiac risk index that you're all familiar with. It's a great paper. Please take a look at it on acc.org. Let me now go to a randomized trial that was just published this week in The Lancet. It's called MANAGE. It's dabigatran in patients with myocardial injury after non-cardiac surgery, an international randomized controlled trial. In this study, the authors recruited patients from 84 hospitals in 19 countries. Patients had to be at least 45. They had undergone non-cardiac surgery. They were within 35 days of that, and they had either an MI or evidence of a troponin release after their non-cardiac surgery. The original intention was to enroll 3,200 patients, but enrollment went slowly, and so between 2013 and 17, 1,754 patients were enrolled between dabigatran or placebo, and the dabigatran dose was 110 milligrams orally twice a day, with the expectation to continue that therapy for 2 years. A couple points about the methods. The one thing that occurred, because the enrollment was slow, they revised the study endpoints and ended up including a couple of non-arterial endpoints like amputation and symptomatic venous thromboembolism. The number of enrolled subjects dropped from 3,200 to 1,700. I mentioned that because of slow enrollment. And a very important point with this trial is nearly 50% of the patients went off either the study drug or the placebo by the two-year interval. So a lot of patients weren't actually taking the drug. The authors reported that the primary endpoint, which was a composite, was lowered by dabigatran. 3% of patients in the dabigatran group and 4% of patients in the placebo group, and they argue that this was a significant benefit. This is one of those trials that, if you dig deeper, it raises some questions, okay? Obviously, if you cut the enrollment target in half during a trial because enrollment is slow, and you start adding endpoints to a trial, particularly endpoints like venous thromboembolism, where you know the study drug has benefit over placebo, it creates questions. And the other thing is that this study actually was supported by a pharmaceutical, and the authors point out that the pharmaceutical had a significant hand in designing the trial, which makes you suspicious from the get-go. The type of patients in the trial, orthopedic in general, were the lion's share, were, you know, not particularly high risk. Vascular surgery was just 15%, thoracic surgery 5%. So not a super high-risk group. Now, it's interesting, when you look at the endpoints, the authors argued that the composite of vascular mortality, non-fatal MI, non-hemorrhagic stroke, peripheral arterial thrombosis, amputation, symptomatic venous thromboembolism was lowered. That went from 15% in placebo to 11% in the dabigatran. And when they looked at secondary outcomes, they argued that major bleeding was not more common in the dabigatran group, which obviously seems a little surprising. And actually, when I looked more deeply at the results, I was struck by a couple of things. First, in the secondary safety outcomes, lower GI bleeding was much more common in the patients getting dabigatran. There were 33 patients in that group versus 7 in placebo. Clinically significant lower GI bleeding, 15 versus 6. Dyspepsia was more common. And so what we could say is that some of these endpoints that didn't make it into the primary composite were, as you'd expect, way more common with the dabigatran group. It's interesting, if you think about measuring troponin after non-cardiac surgery and then putting a person who has evidence of some myocardial injury but doesn't have a clinical MI, the notion of putting all of those people on 2 years of a direct oral anticoagulant to me just seems like a stretch. And if you look at a trial that originally had a target population of 3,200, they drop it to 1,750, then they change the endpoints midstream, it's a problem. So I guess I would say to you, I've been in the perioperative space in terms of research and writing for many years. This single trial, which has significant methodologic limitations, does not inform my practice. I think we need more information. Certainly we need to understand better what to do with postoperative troponin release and whether there are therapeutic options there that make a difference. I, for one, am not convinced yet that direct oral anticoagulants are the way to go. It may be, but we would need at least a confirmatory trial or two before I would be convinced, especially with this dark side risk of bleeding, which certainly was seen and managed, but was not part of the primary composite endpoint. So, you know, in summary, I've covered a couple of areas of perioperative medicine that cardiologists managed to find their way into quite a bit. I hope that you will go onto the website and look these articles up if you would like. I want to thank you for listening to Eagle's Eye View. This is your cardiovascular update from ACC.org. You can get this online or wherever you get your podcasts. As usual, it's a pleasure for me to bring you what I think are important and potentially practice-changing information every week. Thank you.